Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
We're now 2 weeks into the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, and things are different this year. This is Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Ramadan is a time for fasting, good deeds, and charity for Muslims around the world and here in Chicago. But the holiday's usual celebrations are more somber due to the war in Gaza, where the Gazan Health Ministry says around 32,000 people have been killed, the majority of them women and children. There's also a humanitarian crisis in the Strip, with many people starving. Now, during this time, Muslims in Chicagoland, especially Muslim Palestinian Americans, they're coming together to support each other. I sat down with a group of local Palestinian Americans to discuss how Ramadan feels this year. Jamila Shilo is author of the children's book Laith the Lion Goes to Palestine. Ahla Abusaman grew up in a refugee camp in Gaza before moving to Bolingbrook over a decade ago. And Ahmed Jatan is the director of organizing and advocacy for nonprofit the Inner City Muslim Action Network. I caught up with them after Ramadan had just begun. Now, one note, you will hear two of our guests call the war in Gaza a genocide. In late January, a top United Nations court, the International Court of Justice, said it's, quote, plausible that Israel has violated the Genocide Convention established by the UN in 1948. Israel denies the claim. We'll hear from Jamila Shilo first.
I think this year for me, it's different because I have this knot of dread in my stomach at all times. Mm. So it's not that I don't want to celebrate and I don't want to have joy. It's that it feels like the joy has been stolen, because how can I celebrate? How can I have, and the word in Arabic is farah, it's joyfulness. How can I have joyfulness when I know that so many people are literally starving, when so many people have been killed, when there's a literal genocide going on. And when I see the images of the children that have been harmed, they look like my children. And so do I believe that this year is going to be like the most joyous Ramadan that we've ever celebrated? No, but do I find it to be like a passionate Ramadan? Yeah, because I think it's kind of lit a fire in me, because part of fasting isn't just refraining from food and water. It's also stopping things like injustice. And I now can't help but try to stop every kind of injustice. Like, I see it everywhere, and it's like I'm training my children to be the type of people that want to stop injustice.
Ada, as I mentioned, you grew up in Gaza, right? And you've celebrated many Ramadans there. How do those experiences years ago compare to the images that you're seeing right now coming out of the Strip?
I used to sometimes recall memories from my Ramadans in Gaza. Now the face of Gaza is different. Everything's changed. Places we love demolished. People we love have been killed. Memories have been a source of sorrow for me, not a source of happiness. Although Ramadan should be a month of celebration and joy.
There's not a guarantee of peace during the holy month, right? There is a long history here. There are historic moments where the Israeli military has raided Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque, for instance. It's not always peace.
You know what's crazy, as we live here in the United States, right? And we have all this privilege and all this comfort. And I think what happened is that kind of violence became so normalized for us during Ramadan. Like, the expectation is that the Israeli military is going to bomb Gaza at some point. At some point, they're going to raid Al-Aqsa Mosque, and that we are just going to continue living our lives because this is just what happens. And I think for me, like I said before, where, you know, it sort of I have this overwhelming guilt that even though I was doing activism work, I just didn't do enough because I was so complacent, and it led us to this genocide.
The mood is obviously dark, Ahmed, but what is the importance of still creating spaces where you can gather and reflect?
I think about it in terms of, for Ramadan being a spiritual time, a time for spiritual elevation, a time for reflection, a time for prayer, a time for fasting. But as we know, faith without deeds, faith without works is dead. And our works aren't just individual works, but the collective action that we can take. Mm-hmm. And you can't take meaningful collective action without actually building relationships, without sharing stories. And I think part of what's happening now in the midst of this genocide is that people are finally curious to hear the Palestinian story, finally curious to hear it's not just been in since October. It's not just been, you know, in the past several years when people have been starting to see these incursions on Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Yeah.
But since 1948, we don't stay in that hopeless place, in that fearful place. That's not the point of sharing those stories. It's not just to stay in that trauma and to stay in that pain, but to heal through that trauma, through understanding that shared pain, and then being able to engage in a shared struggle.
Also, you're moving from reflection mm-hmm. to action, right?
Yes.
In this month, you're increasing good deeds, charity. What does that look like for you right now, Ahmed?
Yes. So, you know, at Iman, during this month of Ramadan, once a week, we are hosting every Wednesday night an iftar to gather people of all faiths, of all backgrounds, to be able to come through. Mm. To be able to come together and have that moment mm-hmm. and to be able to understand what are some ways that we can actually take action together, not just in terms of how we're understanding what's happening globally, but also what's happening locally.
Yeah, what are some tangible ways that people can help?
Do your research and know who you're voting for, if they align with your values. The other one, too, is it really is at that grassroots level. The more that we know our neighbors, the more that we know each other, the more that we can rely on each other, we've been through some tough times. And I don't have a crystal ball, but I feel like that we are going to continue to face some tough times together, even just here. And the more that we know our neighbors and the more that we can rely on each other, the more that we can get through this together.
We know Muslims here in the U.S. are gathering in mosques right now for the holy month, right? Meanwhile, we've seen, as we've talked about, images of folks in Gaza praying among and on top of rubble, you know, of their destroyed homes and their destroyed places of worship. How does that sit with you, Ahla and Jamila? You first, Jamila.
In Arabic, we have this word tawakkal, which means that you just have faith in God no matter what, that God's plan is always a good plan. And I think that one of the things that when you're Muslim that you have is that you have a belief in the overall goodness of not just God, but of humanity, of the people around you. I think one of the things that in some respects that you can find comforting is that you know that other people who see those images, who are not Muslim, who are not Arab, who are, you know, don't have quote unquote skin in the game, even though we all do because we're complicit in funding, still have a feeling of remorse for those people and still understand that this is wrong. And for me, my family has like a particular saying that we say, and it's, we know what's right, we do what's right even when it's hard, and we try to help people.
Ahla, how are you approaching fasting?
In fact, every time I practice any aspect of Ramadan, you know, rituals, I remember people in Gaza. I see myself in them. I see my kids in their kids. Whenever I break fast, I say, what if I'm breaking my fast now in Rafah or in northern Gaza or anywhere in Gaza? It's very harsh. I talked to my sister this morning. She's in Rafah. She moved from North Gaza to Rafah. And I was asking, how are kids doing? How are you doing? And she started to describe how it's very harsh situation, how it's hard for her, for example, to make the kids, the young kids, understand that we don't have food to eat. We can hardly find something to make our breakfast or dinner. And also the fact that a lot of families who live inside the tents, they have to wake up early in the night, make a fire, try to cook something in that harsh situation. They don't have the luxury of kitchens we have. They don't have the bathrooms we have. They don't have the normal life we have. Everything is lost. And we're talking about people who used to live normal life like us. Yeah. And all of a sudden, they are all now refugees. They are all living in tents, in crowded places, no privacy, no people who have special needs. They don't have anyone to take care of them. People who are sick, they don't have places to go.
What's that like hearing that from your sister, being all the way here and knowing that there's not much you can do to help?
It tears my heart. I feel that, and especially because I live here in the United States, that I feel that our administration is complicit in this crime, sending, you know, military assistant to kill my people, kill my family over there. It's emotionally very hard for me to comprehend what's going on. So we're trying to support them as much as we can, especially emotionally, to stay strong. But sometimes the opposite happening also. Because of their resilience, because of their patience, we also get inspired by them and stay kind of emotionally stable throughout this atrocity.
And, you know, you have lost family members in this war, friends, neighbors. What do you want us to know about some of them?
Every one we lost is valuable to me. Yeah. I mean, I don't rank people whether they're close to me or far to me in terms of like the blood relationship, because every soul is valuable. But I want people to know that the 31,000 people who are killed are not numbers. Everyone has a story, has life. My father-in-law, my mother-in-law, they have been killed in the beginning of this war.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. So the entire family were sleeping at night. They were bombed, and some of the family members were killed immediately because of the bombing. But my father-in-law and my mother-in-law and their their daughter-in-law and her son escaped the bombing. They survived the bombing, but on their way out, they have been shot by a sniper, and their bodies remained on the street for 13 days. You know where is that location? It's a few yards from a Shifa hospital. The hospital is literally across the street, and they were bleeding until death for 13 days,
wow,
days on the street. This is some of the stories that people should know how people are suffering there.
Yeah.
The kids who are having surgeries without anesthesia, you know, women having C-section without anesthesia. Can you imagine that? Can you comprehend that?
I can't.
You know,
I can't.
It's very hard. My wife actually gave birth with C-section. I was with her during the surgery. I know how it's tough. Imagine cutting your stomach without anesthesia. And there are places now in northern Gaza, if you are sick, if you have any health difficulty, nobody can help you. No hospitals. Because Israel basically targeted every, you know, aspect or all the necessities of life for Gazans.
Yeah.
The hospitals, schools, bakeries, factories, homes, everything. Even people, when they rush to take some of the, you know, food assistance that comes to them, Israel shoots at them and kills them.
For additional context here, Ahmed, because I'm not sure that everyone listening understands just how small Gaza is, right? Or how close-knit even the community is. Can you help paint a picture?
Even when we were sitting before this interview, the way that Palestinian networks work, even with the divisions that we have between the West Bank and 48 and diaspora in the United States, what's the family name? And you can immediately make a connection between Palestinians. So Palestinians, even despite all of the divisions that we have,
mm-hmm,
and the geographic ways that we have been dissected and separated, still find a closeness with each other. And that's the closeness of the hearts, even though that when they're trying to cram us together, you know, in unlivable conditions, intentionally unlivable conditions, I think it's that warmth that keeps us going.
What can you add, Akhla?
I mean, I had a chance to visit Gaza in 2022.
Okay.
Just a year before the war. I took my family there. And, you know, normally you want to go any place here in the United States, you just drive your car and go. You cross the border to Canada, to Mexico, anywhere. Or you book a flight and you just go. It's simple. But for people in Gaza to travel, it's a nightmare. Because it took us 2 days to travel from Cairo to Rafah crossing, which normally takes 4 to 5 hours. It took us 2 days with all the checkpoints, all the difficulties on the way. And even you got into Gaza to get out, that's another, you know, process that you have to register, wait a long line, because only few people are allowed to leave every day. So the life in Gaza was really difficult
yeah.
before October 7. And I know a lot of people make connection to October 7. We should remember that this place has been occupied for many years. Mm-hmm. My family was displaced from Palestine in 1948. So we go back even before the occupation of Gaza Strip right. itself.
Right. Earlier, you mentioned the Flower Massacre, as it's being called. And what you're referring to there is February 29th, when more than 100 people were killed, 700 injured, as they were trying to get to an aid convoy. Now, this is according to reporting from the Washington Post.
I want to mention that my parents and the rest of my family are in northern Gaza, and my members of my family were trying to go to that place where they're distributing flour, and they saw all these atrocities, and they were subjected to the shooting from the Israeli military. Mm-hmm. And every time somebody leaves to find something to eat, we don't know if they will come back or not. One time when my brother-in-law could have, a bag of flour and 25 kilos, he hauled it on his back and he walked for over 1.5 hours back home because also there are no transportation. People are suffering in every stage of their life.
So then, Jamila, there's this even bigger focus on charity this yes. month, right? There are a lot of blocks, as we've been talking about, to get that aid through. So I want you to talk about your experience just from here, trying to send support to your family back home.
People don't realize how much effort it takes to send anything into Gaza. Previously, there was a little bit of infrastructure still left in Rafah. So you could possibly send money to a Western Union, and the Western Union had kind of like a system where, certain family names were allowed to get money at certain times. Mm-hmm. And, and it would open like one day a week, and they would distribute the cash that was sent. But if you were trying to send cash and your family got cash like last month, then you would have to wait because there just wasn't enough money to distribute. So there was sort of these roadblocks. And then there's roadblocks from the United States side. So if you are sending, a large amount of cash to the Middle East, in particular into Gaza, your bank accounts will get flagged and frozen. So there are several people who've had their bank accounts flagged and frozen for trying to send money to family to help them to survive. Mm-hmm. So this was in the beginning where there was still a possibility of having money reach people.
But now?
But now, people try to send money. There's really no money to give out. And even if you were trying to send, there's no Western Union. The Western Union's blown up. So, and even if you were to manage to get them that money, it's not like there's food to buy. And if there even is food, the prices are exorbitant. And then a lot of people are trying to raise funds using GoFundMe and things of that nature. I have cousins that live there. Mm-hmm. And they actually, a couple of them had GoFundMes literally to bribe the Egyptian border guards. And those bribes are what they use to enter into Egypt.
So what do you want to see changed?
One, I'd love a ceasefire. Let's start there. Second, United States needs to tell Israel to allow all aid to enter, and they need to build humanitarian corridors so those people who need the aid can get the aid. Second thing, I think that we need to put conditions on any aid that is sent to Israel, if not stop the aid altogether. Also, I think we need to abide by the Geneva Conventions. We need to abide by the rules of the ICJ, and we need to start having a moral code here in the United States that we believe in. So the reality of the situation is what we believe in our core as Americans, that we are just and good people, our government is not taking action on.
There were hopes, Ahmed, mm-hmm. for a ceasefire before Ramadan. So I would love to hear from you what you want to see in the immediate and long term.
What I want to emphasize is that, yes, we need aid to get in because people are starving. More than aid, it's these political solutions that we really need. Because you can't just keep throwing aid while people are getting bombed. The first step is to stop the bombing, to have a ceasefire. And that's the bare minimum. That's the first step.
Allah, leave us with changes you would like to see.
I would like to see more people are taking the streets. You cannot send munition to Israel to kill us and at the same time make airdrops of some food to people who are being starved and killed. So we need to stop this. This is irony. We cannot do this anymore. What's going on in Gaza is a test for our humanity. We need at least the politicians to consider Palestinians as humans like any other humans. And you see in front of your eyes thousands of people being killed. Life. We don't even move. It doesn't move your heart to see people are killed, children suffering, and families starved to death. And until this moment, 25 people died from hunger. We cannot do this anymore. So we have to pressure our politicians. We have to take on the streets. We have to participate on all the protests, all the activities that hold our politicians accountable. The Palestinians deserve to live in peace like any other nation in the world.
We'll leave it there. We have been speaking with local Palestinian Americans Ahla Abu Saman, Jamila Shiloh, and Ahmed Jitan. Thank you all for taking the time. Ramadan Mubarak.
Thank you, Ramadan Mubarak. Thank you for having us.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced and mixed by Max Lubers. It was edited by Meha Ahmed and Dan Tucker. For more interviews about the people, places, and conversations in Chicago, make sure to subscribe to the Reset Podcast wherever you're listening. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll talk again later today.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.